And welcome to the World Affairs Council of Northern California. We're honored to have with us this evening Zachary Chor, Associate Professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. Dr. Chor joins us for a discussion on Islam, both in the United States and Europe. Tonight's program is co-sponsored by Books Incorporated. My name is Jamal Dejani. I'm the Senior Director of Middle Eastern Programming at Link TV and will be your moderator this evening. For those who may be new to this organization, the World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where policymakers, heads of state, business executives, philanthropists, academics, civic leaders, and an attentive public like yours engage in issues of international importance. Please consult the website at www.itsyourworld.org for more information about us. When you cannot attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming audio and video online. Also, if you would like to re-listen to tonight's remarks, I would encourage you to make use of this great collection. Council programs can also be heard on a weekly one-hour radio show called It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m. on National Public Radio. The local channel here is KQED 88.5 FM. Now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other noise-making devices. While you do that, I would like to take this opportunity to announce two upcoming events. Next month, on Thursday, April 9th, join the Council in welcoming Steve Cole, President and CEO of the New America Foundation, for a discussion on the Bin Laden's family, on the Bin Laden's family's rise to power and privilege. The program will take place here in the World Affairs Council's auditorium at 6 p.m. Also, the Council is delighted to announce its 63rd annual conference. Join us as we gather with political leaders, policymakers, public intellectuals, and diplomats to explore the most crucial global issues facing the Obama administration. The Council is proud to welcome to the conference many experts on the Middle East, including Vali Nasser of the Council on Foreign Relations, Ashraf Ghani, former Finance Minister of Afghanistan, and Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. The conference will be held on April 2nd and on April 3rd, just a few blocks from this building, at the San Francisco Westin Hotel, the Westin San Francis Hotel, which is around the corner from here. Lastly, I would encourage you all to make use of the blue question marks right there on your seat. They've been placed on your seats. Please write legibly, English is my fourth language, and hand them over to Council staff members. Audience questions will be posed to Zachary Chor during the second half of our program. Now it's my honor and privilege to introduce our distinguished guest. Zachary Chor is Associate Professor of National Security Affairs at the Naval Postgraduate School. He is also a research scholar at both the Institute of European Studies and the Institute of International Studies at UC Berkeley. He has served on the policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State and has worked as National Security Fellow at Harvard's Olin Institute for Strategic Studies. He's the author of the most recent book right here to my left, Breeding Bin Laden's America, Islam, and the Future of Europe. And I'm pleased to welcome him here for tonight for a discussion on this subject matter. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Zachary Chor.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for letting me talk to you about my favorite obsession, which is an obsession with a single question. And I've had this obsession for several years. It's driven most of my research and each of my last three books. the obsession or the question is, why do people shoot themselves in the foot? I know it's a strange thing to make a living out of, but that's what I do. I ask this question in a variety of contexts. In my first book, What Hitler Knew, I showed, how Hitler limited his own power to make informed decisions by the very system he created. And in my second book, I tackle this question again, but in a very different context. Now I ask, why is it that America and Europe are alienating the very people they should most want to attract, moderate religious Muslims? That's the book I'm going to talk to you about tonight, and mostly what I'll be doing is sharing with you some travel stories drawn from my journeys across Muslim Europe. But before I do that, I need to tell you a little bit about my third book, my most recent book, which is called Blunder: Why Smart People Make Bad Decisions. Exactly. Blunder is really a historian's take on judgment. It's a history of judgment calls. And what I do is I try to get at what are the roots of bad decisions as well as good ones. I'm a historian of decision making. This is a field that does not actually exist. But I'm nonetheless doing it, and that's what drives my work. So in the Blunder book, I range across vast periods from ancient Greece to present-day Iraq and a variety of fields, from whether it's international relations or romantic relations, whether it's medical mishaps or business blunders. And after you look at all these different kinds of cases of poor judgment, certain categorizable, rigid mindsets start to appear and recur. I call these rigid mindsets cognition traps. And so in each chapter of the Blunder book, I offer a different cognition trap and show how that mindset led people into blunders. For example, exposure anxiety, a fear of being seen as weak or flawed, or cure-allism, which is a dogmatic belief in one-size solutions. It's the idea that you can take a solution that has worked well in one area and then apply it to places where it doesn't belong. And in the book, I use this to explain the roots of the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, but it also helps to explain a lot of the financial crisis we find ourselves in today. One other cognition trap is called infomania, an obsessive relationship to information. And by the way, there are two types of infomaniacs. There are the infomisers, people who hoard information, never let anybody else know what's going on. And then there are the infovoiders, people who shun information, even when that knowledge could help them to avert a blunder. There are so many books about decision making right now, but most of them are written by neuroscientists, where they look at the amount of dopamine in the brain, or they're by psychologists or behavioral economists or other social scientists. And what they do is they construct carefully controlled experiments in a laboratory, and they run people through them like rats in a maze. And there can be a great deal of insight to result from these kinds of experiments, but historians don't have that luxury. History is a very unkind laboratory. Instead, we have to deal with how people actually behaved and the decisions they made under real-world circumstances, when we couldn't isolate variables, when we couldn't control the circumstances. And so it's my hope that through the stories I tell in the book and through these cognition trap labels, which are mnemonic devices, people will have something to hold on to and use and actually apply them in order to make better, wiser decisions in all our lives. Okay. Now, I've told you all about the Blunder book, not simply to make a shameless plug for it, that's one reason, but also because I want you to hold in mind this concept of self-sabotage and cognition traps as we now look at one of the hottest flashpoints in religious and cultural tension in the world today. In early 2002, I started researching this topic of Europe's Muslims. And it took me across the continent, from Britain to Germany to France, Holland, Denmark, Slovenia, Czech Republic, Turkey, and it took me into the mosques, community centers, and very often the homes of average Muslims. I ate extremely well during these years of Dharma. People were incredibly generous and kind. And what I've tried to do is share their stories with my readers. Among the things that I found, two of the themes I'll stress tonight are these. One is that pan-Islamism is rising among the young. And pan-Islamism is just this idea that you identify yourself first and primarily with Islam, as opposed to with your host country or the country of your parents' birth. Obviously, we all have multiple identities, and identities are fluid. But among the young, something very interesting and different is happening. We are used to seeing in America this kind of pattern where each subsequent generation after the first generation of immigrants come, the children, then the grandchildren, each become successively more integrated and often more assimilated into the mainstream culture. The opposite is happening in Europe right now. There is a growing body of younger Muslims in the second, third, fourth generation who are actually becoming less well integrated than their parents or grandparents. And this is concerning for a number of reasons. That's one issue. The other is that I found remarkably little true anti-Americanism inside Muslim Europe. But I did find a great deal of ambivalence. Ambivalence toward not only America, but toward Europe and toward Islam's place in the growing European Union. And so for that reason, I tend to speak a lot more about, not about anti-Americanism, but ambivalent Americanism, or ambi-Americanism for short. So as I now share with you these five stories, I want you to see how both these things, rising pan-Islamism and more this sense of deep ambivalence or ambi-Americanism, how that's manifested in these people's tales. You will also see that at the root of these issues, they're questions about values and identities. Okay, let's start with story number one, Director Khan. 1 week after the July 7th bombings of the London Underground, I was scheduled to see Dilawar Khan, who is director of the largest mosque in Britain, and possibly the largest mosque in Western Europe. When my visit was arranged many weeks before, obviously I was not expecting that the mosque would be packed with journalists and film crews and security guards. I had to push my way past packs of people just to squeeze my way through and up to Director Khan's office. It was an especially poignant time to arrive because only the night before the mosque learned that one of its congregants, a young woman named Shahara Islam, was killed in those bombings. She was one of the 55 victims of those attacks. I should tell you a little bit about the mosque, by the way. It's a very impressive complex, nearly a block long, four stories high. It has suites of fully accredited classrooms. It has a large library of Islamic thought and teaching, and it has even a radio station on the top floor. And when I was there, they were getting ready to bring halal restaurants in on the ground floor. In the course of my interview with Director Khan, he told me many, many things. But among them are that America wants to dominate the world's resources, that it wants to ensure that Muslim countries never become powerful, and that Israel controls U.S. foreign policy. Now, whether you agree or disagree with Director Khan's views, I think the important thing to note here is that this is one of Britain's most prominent mainstream Muslim leaders. And he tells me that his views are shared by the vast majority of his congregants. That congregation, by the way, numbers in the thousands. Story number two. I love New York. Another person I met was named Malik, 29 years old, born in Morocco, educated in Frankfurt, Germany. I met him in Germany, interviewed him there, and so the translations are my own. I want to quote from him directly, and I apologize for the strong wording of his language. He said to me, quote, "America's policies are shit. It's the arrogance of your country that we hate the most. You go around telling everyone that your democracy is best and everyone should do things your way. Well, your democracy is weak." Okay, maybe some Arab countries don't have democracy or freedom, he says, but they have their ways, we have ours. If you go around telling me that your food is best and my food is crap, I'll resent you. So keep your nose out of my plate. "Have you ever been to America?" I asked him. "Ah, I dream about going to America." All right, now slow down here. You just told me that America is arrogant and full of terrible policies. Why would you want to go there? And then Malik says something that I think is revealing. He says, look, all right, maybe as an Arab man, I wouldn't go there. And this was a few years after 9/11, not too much long after. He said, maybe I wouldn't go there just now, but I really want to experience New York. I want to understand the people and the culture. I want to walk the streets and understand what's going on there, the speed at which it produces everything. The technology is amazing. And then he adds something else. Malik said, look, I can wear Nike and Reebok clothing without necessarily supporting everything that America stands for. And I think that's fair enough. And I believe it is reflective of what many other younger European Muslims have said to me. They have a true love-hate relationship with the country. Story number three we'll call Cheering 9/11. Another person I met was named Faisal, and he was in his mid-20s when he was working for an Arab embassy in London. He tells me that he will never forget 9/11, mainly because of what happened inside the embassy on that day. When the second plane struck the second tower, he says that people practically cheered. And for the rest of that day, they went around practically gleeful that America had finally gotten a poke in the eye for its arrogance. And then a weird thing started to happen over the next few days. A strange state of denial occurred. As it became clear that Muslims had been responsible for these attacks, the same people in the embassy who had been almost proud of what had happened, he says, now insisted that Muslims could not have been responsible and the whole thing had to be an Israeli conspiracy. Now, one thing you may be thinking at this point, I should point out also that this is not the Arab street, but these were educated bureaucrats working in an embassy in London, fully exposed to Western media, Western products, and so on. You may be wondering, well, are all these problems of ambivalence and resentment simply a product of the Bush administration? Well, that's not what this story would reflect, since it happens in 9/11, long before the invasion of Iraq, long before Abu Ghraib. Some people think that the election of President Obama will sweep away all these problems. After all, his middle name is Hussein, and he talks a different language, he's much more diplomatic. Surely everything's going to be okay now. Having studied these things for several years, I can tell you that that's not the case. The problems run much deeper than that, deeper than the policies and deeper than the past 8 years of the Bush administration. These are the tensions and problems that President Obama now inherits and with which he must now deal. Story number four, on the outskirts of Prague. Now, I have to confess to you, I'm a very odd tourist. Most people go, say, to Paris for the food or to Berlin for the beer and the history. I go around asking, where's the local Muslim community center? And how can I get there? And how can I talk to people? And one of the interesting experiences I had in Prague, in the Czech Republic, came when I stepped away from all the marvelous tourist attractions of that city and went down a noisy, nondescript commercial road on the outskirts of the city. And there I came to a modern-looking shopping mall. If the signs had not been in Czech, you would probably have thought you were in any major American city. And if you take an unmarked staircase up to the top of the mall, there's a converted office area of four tiny little rooms. And this is the Islamic Community Center of Prague. Size-wise, it's the polar opposite of that mosque I described in London's Bethnal Green with Dilawar Khan. Here they have a tiny little entryway, a small little library of a few books, one larger rectangular carpeted prayer room, and then a cramped office room with two desks and a single computer. That's the administrative center. And there I met a young man named Rafiq, 24-year-old mechanical engineering student from Saudi Arabia. He wears a long, thick black beard and has tremendous youthful enthusiasm, but his enthusiasm for Islam is most apparent as soon as we start speaking. Like so many of the young people I met across Europe, he found that it was only in Europe that he became a devout Muslim, not growing up in Saudi Arabia. And that's true of many of the second and third generation Muslims I met who've been born and raised in Europe. They maybe grew up in moderately religious homes, but many of them had a sort of conversion experience around age 19, 20, 21 that seemed to be the sweet spot, and became much more active and involved. In Rafiq's case, it went like this. He had come to Prague at age 21. His father had studied in Germany years before, and he thought it would be helpful for his son to have education abroad. And so one day, he was over a friend's apartment in Prague, a Muslim friend, and that guy was downloading Quranic songs off the internet. Suddenly, some kind of switch flipped right inside Rafiq, and he decided that he wanted to learn everything he could about Islam. And that began a real conversion process. He told me that he had wrecked his stomach with alcohol and drugs and had sex with all kinds of women beforehand, and now he got married that year and changed his lifestyle completely, became active in the community center. He said to me, look, if you're a young man and you want to have sex, Islam has an answer. Get married. And it has all of the answers, he said, that we need to live our lives. And these are good for all people. So I asked him if he thought that Sharia should become the law of the land in Europe. He didn't answer directly. He thought about it, and he said, well, I'd like to see it come to the Muslim lands first. And then he said something that surprised me. He said, what we really don't want is democracy. Now, I was surprised by this because nearly all of the young Muslims I interviewed over many years very much wanted and supported democracy and thought it was a great thing so long as they could participate in it and have equal rights, which many do not have. Rafiq, on the other hand, felt democracy is a bad thing because certain special interest groups can gain power and advance their agendas. And he used as an example gay rights organizations. He said, they're now advancing this agenda of gay marriage, and this is something that Islam can never condone. This made me wonder if Rafiq really would like to see Sharia become the law of the land in Europe. I don't know. I can't say how prevalent his view really is, but I can cite one study, which I would take with a grain of salt, by a German sociologist. It was a large-scale study of younger European Muslims in their 20s and teens. And in that study, a majority, 54%, said that they should not adapt too much to Western ways, but should instead live according to Islam. Okay. Story number five, last story. I call this one Clash of the Barbies. Appleton, Wisconsin, probably strikes you as an unlikely birthplace for the founder of a Muslim Barbie doll, but that is in fact where Noor Saadeh was born and raised. She and her husband came up with the idea for the Muslim Barbie in the late 1990s when they saw all of the little girls in the neighborhood getting Barbies as gifts, and Noor wanted to give her own daughter a doll, but one that would be more modestly figured, modestly dressed, and without the array of material possessions that Barbie has. In other words, no Malibu beach house, no fancy sports car, and definitely not the boyfriend like Ken. So to make clear that Razan is a modern Muslim woman, or girl, they created the doll in several different forms. There's a praying Razan, who comes in a long flowing prayer gown with prayer mat. There's a teacher Razan, dressed in business suit with a little mini laptop. There is a community service Razan, who donates her free time at the local hospital. And there's also what they called an in-and-out Razan. And this doll is dressed in colorful Western-style clothing at home, but she also has an additional covering-up outfit for stepping out on the town. And this doll is designed to show that Muslim women have fun, too. They just dress appropriately according to the context. Noor said to me, "We're trying to break down stereotypes one dolly at a time." Razan is slowly penetrating European markets. The Saudis have opened up distributorships in Britain and Germany and beyond. But for now, they only sell about 30,000 units per year. It's not likely that they are going to challenge Barbie anytime soon. Some of you may have heard that Barbie just celebrated her 50th anniversary this month. And since that introduction in 1959, they have sold, brace yourselves, more than 1 billion Barbies. Only 6 billion people on the planet. So putting that in perspective, it's pretty awesome. That means that Razan could not possibly pose an economic challenge to Barbie. And that's really not the point. That's not what this is about. I think that the rise of Islamically oriented businesses, and there are many, represents something much deeper. In fact, I devoted a whole chapter of the book to this subject. I think that they're not just capitalist enterprises trying to fill a niche market. I think instead, what they want to do is not just make money like any other company. Of course they want to do that. But they also want to make sure that they're not advancing un-Islamic values. So when Razan's creators, the Saudis, decided to make the doll more modestly figured and modestly dressed and without all of those material possessions, they were making a statement, an implied critique of mainstream European and American culture, material culture. Or when, for example, the Islamic Bank of Britain declares in its slogan, "It's your choice," they're taking a stand against the charging of interest, something they view as an unethical business practice. Or when the internet shopping portal, Zades, declares that they are commanded to pay their workers before their sweat dries. They're taking a stand on economic justice. And when Qibla Cola or Mecca Cola, both companies founded by British and French Muslims, when they declare that they're going to give a fixed percentage of their profits to charity, they're taking a stand on social justice. What I'm trying to get across here is that the deep ambivalence toward mainstream, or better put, perceived mainstream values can be seen in a host of acts beyond just purchasing patterns. You can see it in someone like Felicia, a drummer in a Hamburg band who at age 19 decided to swear off Bratwurst and beer and the company of young women. Or you can hear it from Rafiq, that Saudi student I interviewed in Prague, who said that Western men go through women like cigarettes. You can see it in the burqas of Bengali women in London's Bethnal Green, women choosing to wear the burqa. Or you can see it behind the veils of schoolgirls or school teachers who refuse to uncover, even when that could mean expulsion or unemployment. And you can see it reflected in these studies that show a majority of younger Muslims affirming that they should not adapt too much to Western ways, but should instead live according to Islam. I think that that last statement is the most concerning of all, because it strongly suggests that either the survey takers or the survey makers view Islam as incompatible with Western ways. And it is that concept that really strikes at the heart of Europe's identity minefield. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Now we're going to go to your questions here. some of them we might not get to all of the questions, but some are similar, so we might just consolidate them. First question here: what would you tell Obama to do vis-a-vis Palestine, Pakistan, and Afghanistan?
Perfect. A question on a subject about which I know nothing. Okay. Good way to start. I'm not a Middle East expert. I'm a Europeanist, a European historian by training, so I'm not the right person to answer that question. But what I can say is this. We need to make a break, and I think he will do this, make a break with some of the mindset and the language of the Bush administration. And that mindset was one of war, and a warlike language reflected that. What we need to do is get away from this idea of a battle for hearts and minds or a war of ideas. That kind of language frames the whole issue. It frames Muslims as the enemy on a battle space that has to be conquered. It doesn't attract the people that we want to attract. If we can get away from that language and that mindset, I think we'll have a much better chance of making progress toward including and bringing in people who could be drawn potentially toward extremism or could be drawn the other way toward greater inclusion and feeling a part of a society and feeling that they are stakeholders in the West.
Okay, we have this question here. What do you see as the principal forces causing the attitude of ambiguity towards the United States?
Good question. There are many, many causes, never just one. Some of them are Europe's failed integration strategies. A lot of these policies were not carefully thought out, and they had the effect of self-sabotage. They alienate the people they want to attract. Also, the spread of radical teachings. Another is a sense of siege that many people feel, now linked by internet and cable television, able to see Muslims under siege in a whole variety of ways around the world, whether it's Kashmir, Chechnya, the Middle East, wherever it may be, and then feeling a sense of siege at home as well, that headscarves are too visible, that the mosques are too high, that the call to prayer is too loud in Europe. These are some of the issues that have fomented so much anger and resentment. You've seen the riots and the protests against Danish cartoons, the riots in France. There are so many causes, but they come down to, I think, a sense of alienation and exclusion from mainstream society. So these are the things that have to be worked on.
Just following up on this, how much of this really has to do with Islam, and how much of it is just socioeconomic? Let's talk about the 60s here, or things that affected the African American community and feeling the alienation and the resentment.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. This is part of the problem, is that the perception is on the ethnic European side that Islam is the problem, and when that's not the case at all. And so these are the attitudes that have to be broken down. It's been much harder in Europe than in the United States because of these socioeconomic factors. What you have, different from the United States, in Europe you have many more people coming to Europe who are drawn from rural areas coming to big cities. It's hard enough to move from a rural area to a big city and try to start a life there in your own country. But to come to a foreign country where you don't speak the language and don't know the culture is much more difficult. Then, as you move down the generations, it's been difficult for ethnic Europeans to accept and integrate the children of those immigrants. And so these things are far more socioeconomic and not religious in nature. The problem is that they're viewed, because it's easy to say, the problem is Islam, they fall into this category. That's what we're trying to overcome. Thank you.
And this is actually on the same kind of topic here from John. Young people in the U.S., Latin America, and Africa are joining evangelical Christian churches in large numbers. Do you see this as similar to young Muslims in Europe committing themselves to Islam?
That's a good question. I don't know about that. I think it has in part to do with the nature of globalization and the ability to see what's going on around the world in ways that you couldn't be, and to connect to groups that would have been more difficult in the past to connect to, but not impossible. Look, there was a time towards the end, middle and end of the 19th century, when Catholics in the United States were viewed as very alien forces who could not integrate into mainstream society because they were part of this larger global movement of Catholics. They had this leader far away. And the movement was called Ultramontanism, beyond the mountains, where the Pope would be. And ultramontanes were looked upon as a danger to American society. There are some very good books on this that explain the roots of the problem. But in time, that was overcome as Catholics became better integrated into the society. Those prejudices ebbed away. And so I'm actually hopeful about the condition of Europe's Muslims if the right policies and strategies are taken now.
This is from Grace from Skyline High School. And why are European Muslims less integrated than the Muslims in the U.S. if you think that Muslims are more integrated here?
That has to do with the different nature of the groups. In the United States, Muslims on the whole are better educated, have higher incomes, and again, we're back to a socioeconomic problem. In Europe, they are more drawn from rural areas, they have lower incomes, and also many are living in pockets, in areas that are more isolated, and that only reinforces the prejudices. As we saw in Holland, where we've had protests after the murder of Theo van Gogh. He was assassinated by an extremist, but that then prompted some hostility toward Muslims, and it went back and forth. A lot of Muslims in Holland, for example, are concentrated in areas and living in separate parts of cities, and so it becomes much harder for the integration to take place. We don't have the same situation in the United States.
Do you do you feel just socioeconomic, or the upbringing and the background? For example, a large Muslim community comes from Pakistan and India in England, versus a lot of people come here from Middle Eastern countries, Lebanon, etc. Did you feel, when we talk about Europe, we kind of generalize the whole area.
So what are you asking about?
Well, when you went to Europe, when we talk about Europe in general, I mean, when I travel myself, I feel there is a difference, between Muslims, let's say, going in France versus the Muslims that live in England.
Right.
And the background about the degree and the way people identify themselves with Islam. Here, a lot of Muslims that I meet, it's more an identification with Islam, like someone might refer to themselves as, I'm Jewish. They may be religious or they might not be religious, but there it's more like apparent who are the religious ones and who are the kind of like
yes.
a certain identification with it.
Yes, that's right. Okay, so you're pointing out two things: how identities differ, the role of Islam as a primary identity in Europe as opposed to the U.S., and also how it's such a dramatically diverse population of Muslims across Europe, it's remarkable that any patterns should emerge at all. When you have so many different languages and different parts of the world represented as Muslims across Europe, the thing that struck me was that this one pattern of a growing sense of pan-Islamism does emerge among the young, and I take this as an indication of the failure of Europe's integration strategies.
Now, it's a question from the audience here. The love-hate relationship that you talked about, you mentioned about with the U.S., but what about with their host European country? What's stronger for them when you interviewed all these people? You know, a lot of them, you know, explained to you about their love-hate relationship with the United States, but what about their own host country?
Good question. Yes, I'd say there's an element of love-hate there as well, of deep ambivalence. The ambivalence is not only toward America, so we have not only ambi-Americanism, but ambi-Europeanism. There's a significant difference here that I should point out. If you ask, say, a religious Christian, for example, living in the heartland of the U.S., and someone who might feel uneasy with or alienated by aspects of mainstream American culture, you might say, do you have trouble with some of the values you see expressed on television and in mainstream products and so on? And he'd say, absolutely, I do. But if you ask that person then, do you feel yourself an American? He'd say, of course. I mean, look at the flags flying in my front lawn. Turn the question around now and ask that of a Muslim European. Do you feel French or German? You will get a different answer. You'll say, do you have ambivalence toward the mainstream values? Yes. Do you feel yourself connected and a part of that society you're in, France or Germany, whatever, Holland? The answer is no, more often than not. We'd like to feel, but it's very difficult. And this raises another question, the question of integration versus assimilation. Many Muslims will say to me, look, of course we want to integrate, but assimilate, never. And I think there's a certain inconsistency or hypocrisy on the part of ethnic Europe that says, in other words, white Europe, that says, look, we want you to integrate, but what we really want is for you to assimilate. We don't want to see the visible signs of Islam. We don't want you to be devout, observant, practicing. We don't want it in our face. We don't want to see the mosques. We don't want it in our streets. We don't want to hear a call to prayer. We don't want to know about it. We want you to be just like us. But of course, on the other hand, we want to provide a multicultural society where everyone can feel comfortable. So there's an inconsistency here. This tension of what is desired is at the heart of a lot of the problems surrounding Europe's Muslims.
Now, with the European Muslims, I mean, they all have a history with colonialism. You know, the Pakistanis or people that came from India, they can cite the British Empire, the ones that live in France, the Algerians, they tell you more than a million Algerians were perished because of the French colonialism. But until the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, most Muslims that come from different regions, especially vis-a-vis the United States never had a history of colonialism in the Muslim world. Did you find a difference between how people related to this before 9/11, or before the United States went into Iraq as a result of 9/11?
If you're asking, is the colonial past a factor in these tensions? Absolutely. Yeah, I think it absolutely shapes the present. There's something else that I think should be said. The current Pope has a book out right now called Without Roots. And it condemns Europe for its relativism. And it says that Christianity is the source of what makes Europe Europe. And he argues, as I understand it from the reading, look, people from former colonies and from other Muslim lands are coming to Europe, not the other way around. And this he takes as a sign that Western ways are more desirable. I think it's much more complicated than that. People come to Western countries for a whole host of reasons. Sometimes it's to escape persecution, for freedoms, for these things. It can also be purely to make more money and send it back home in the form of remittances. There are many reasons why people do this. So, yes, the colonial legacies shape the past, but not completely.
since we are on the Pope issue, is a question, how can we teach forgiveness and create peace here now?
Great question. That should probably lead me to plug my blunder book, but since I've already done that, yeah, these are tough questions. And again, I go back to starting with the mindset. This is my approach on most of these things. Get at the roots of what we really assume about other people and other cultures and challenge them. There's a book out right now by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers, a very popular book. If you've seen that, you'll see that it makes a fairly common cultural argument that people are the way they are because of their culture and their deep history. This is partly true. Culture absolutely shapes how people act today. Their past influences the present. We know this. But it's not everything. There are so many more factors, and people are not automata, not pawns of their past or their culture. And so if we want to get at forgiveness and understanding, we have to look at all the factors that drive people. What's really motivating people? And I think the best approaches on these issues are the ones that try to put ourselves in the minds and hearts of other people who are different from us and really figure out what's driving them. When we can do that, then we can make much bigger leaps toward peace and understanding.
And here someone wants you to be specific and says, how do you propose to integrate a reluctant Islamic population? And the use of the word here, there is reluctant. I don't know if it's a reluctant, but...
Right. Well, there's different parts. There's difference between reluctant and adamantly opposed and very open to being integrated. Those that are adamantly opposed, you probably won't reach. But they're fortunately in a minority, a very small minority. The ones who are reluctant need to be drawn in through better integration policies. That's one thing. I do lay out a number of these things in the epilogue of Breeding Bin Ladens. They are sometimes simple things and sometimes bigger policy issues. One, for example, we've had a fairly successful Head Start program in the U.S. that has helped integrate people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. What if you adapted that program and targeted that towards European Muslims? And I lay out a lot of different ways in which you could do that in a cost-effective manner. Getting volunteer teachers who are currently unemployed, looking for practical experiences, who've just finished their practicums, and give them a chance to work with Muslim kids and get them a head start. Because when you look at the problem of alienation, you can trace it back to very early on. Kids who are born into families where they don't speak the host language at home, then they start school and they're behind the eight ball. They don't have the language skills, and they don't have a lot of the cultural skills and other skills you need to succeed in school. Therefore, their graduation rates are much lower, incomes are lower, their rates of crime become higher, all kinds of social ills. They start at an early age. So what if you adapted the Head Start program, targeted it towards Muslims? I think that would be one way.
So what's the difference between what you've observed there in that rediscovering of Islam between, say, new immigrants, first generation, and the young and versus the old? Mm-hmm. Did you find first generation were more integrated, or it didn't matter whether you're a new immigrant or you were born in England or France or Germany?
No, it's been much more one of the few interesting patterns is that mostly the second, third, even fourth generation of Muslims are growing in the sense of pan-Islamism, identifying themselves more as Muslims first, unlike their parents or grandparents who may have wanted to integrate or tried in ways that failed. This is a case where people already start out feeling excluded from the larger society and are looking for, we all want, obviously, to be part of something larger than ourselves. We're looking for some kind of larger issue or ideology to attach ourselves, to be part of something larger. And that something larger has been, for many people, nationalism. And that's not been open to a lot of younger European Muslims in the second, third, fourth generations, because they've been made to feel not a part of their host society. And in the same way, they no longer feel the same attachment to the country of birth of their parents or grandparents, whether it was Turkey or Morocco. They've never been there. It's not salient for them. And what does that leave? In this era of globalization and a tightening together of ideas and movements, people are turning to Islam as that larger something to attach themselves to. So it has been very much a trend of younger generations.
So someone asks, how long has this alienation of European Muslims been going on? What have been the major events, if any, that have accelerated this alienation besides 9/11?
Mm-hmm. I've just been describing the issues of education and how starting out behind the eight ball can set you back and lead to all those social ills of higher crime rates, higher unemployment rates. That's part of it. There's no one cause. This is one thing that historians always try to get across. We don't believe in monocausality because it's so rare. Usually, complex phenomena have complex and multiple causes. So in addition to things like bad policies of the U.S. that have been alienating and failed strategies on the part of Europeans, you also get inflammatory acts by Europeans, like the publishing of the Danish cartoons, and or inflammatory statements by leading politicians, like those perhaps by Sarkozy after the riots in France. But these are more superficial, and there are actually, the problems go much, much deeper and earlier to when large-scale immigration began after the Second World War. And the phrase that I think sticks was written by a German who said, "Wir riefen Arbeiter, aber Menschen kamen." We called for workers, but people came.
Well, since in the title of your book you use the name Bin Laden, and I actually was looking for a question about Bin Laden, I didn't see one. How much influence do you feel, at least the young, the ones that surf the net, because there was a, including here in the United States, a big hype about encoded messages that Bin Laden was sending, you know, in his speeches to the youth or through websites. How much influence does this play, you know, in converting those young people into the new Bin Ladens?
Most people don't want to be terrorists. Most people don't want to blow themselves up. Most people just want to get through the day. They want to have a better chance at a future where they can make some money, make a better life for themselves and for their kids. And that's normal and standard around the world. Just, it's not an attractive, it's not alluring to say, let's blow ourselves up, to most people. There are a lot of studies on what drives extremism. I'm not that concerned about Bin Laden or Al-Qaeda infiltrating. This, it is real. It's there. I don't want to minimize the threat and the danger, but that's not what's really at the root of the majority of the problems. For the vast majority of Europe's Muslims, they'll surf the web. Yes, young people surf the web. They find all kinds of things, and there's so much out there. Anything you want to find, you can find it. Think about the person I described, Rafiq. His friend was downloading Quranic songs off the internet and then decided he wanted to learn more about Islam. What's wrong with that? Well, there's also sites that tell you, and I've read them, don't be part of European society if you're living in Europe. You need to separate yourself from the larger society. You need to live according to these laws. Here's what you should do. It's out there. It's a real danger. But fortunately, it's not that attractive to most people who do really want to be part of the larger mainstream society if they could, if they were made to feel included. It would be a much more attractive option.
Why is it then that Europe hasn't done a better job at integrating European Muslims? Don't they care?
Again, there are a lot of reasons. They came without the expectation that they would stay, and they don't have the same idea. Yes, we have a myth of a melting pot, but in fairness, America is a very different kind of country where all kinds of people can come and at least have a shot at making a better life for themselves. Well, since very different populations came, Europeans don't have that same exact attitude. Obviously, it's been changing over time, and some countries have different attitudes than others within Europe, but on the whole, there's been a resistance to changing. And I think that when you see issues flare up over things like headscarves, why did the French overwhelmingly pass a national law to ban headscarves from schoolgirls? Are little schoolgirls wearing a scarf going to threaten the French Republic? I mean, come on, be serious. This issue obviously did not have to do with headscarves. It had to do with an anxiety of what it means to be French or European. It has always meant one thing, a secular, nationalistic, sharing certain common values. And now, here's how one Danish scholar put it to me. He said, look, we've had these problems in Denmark because for hundreds of years, Denmark has been essentially a monoculture. We all look the same, we act the same, we have the same values. Now, suddenly, Danes are coming into close contact with people who really look and act and think and behave differently from them, and they're scared.
Well, I'm going to give you an opportunity before we run out of time to plug your book, your new book, because I guess, to follow up on your, this is a question from David, to follow up on your most recent book, what's in your opinion is the biggest blunder in history, or why would, one out of five, or what the top five, I guess, top five blunders.
I shudder to think that we may be living through it right now. I don't rank the blunders in the blunder book because there are so many and they're all so bad. You can take your pick from the book. But I will say this. One of the biggest factors that leads to blunders of all kinds is the inability to empathize. If we could just heighten our empathy, we would do so much better. And so instead of just talking about people who made blunders in the blunder book, in each chapter I contrast that with people in comparable circumstances who didn't fall into those blunders or those rigid mindsets. And I try to figure out why, what made these people different. And on the whole, what made them different was a far greater degree of empathy, meaning being able to put themselves not only in the minds, but in the hearts of the people they were dealing with. Try to figure out what drove them. And that greater empathy, I think, is what we need to avoid blunders and make better, wiser decisions.
Well, we're coming to a close to our program here. I want to thank you on behalf of the World Affairs Council. That concludes our program for this evening.
For radio, we need to do 5 minutes.
Okay, 5 more minutes for radio, so I'll take one more question. And here is one, actually. Doesn't the spiritual nature of Islam fill some of the void left by Western modernism? Doesn't the spiritual nature of Islam fill some of the void left by the Western modernism? That's...
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's
modernism,
the...
Modernism, yeah.
Yes, that's exactly the idea. Modernity has left a lot of people, not just Muslims, feeling empty. There's a void here. And that's a lot of what you see in the people I interviewed and in surveys and in all kinds of things. People are reacting in ways that they show that they need something more to their lives. And a lot of what I talk about, whether it's the rise of Muslim businesses advancing Islamic values or whether it's voting patterns, I try to look not just at what it is that people say, which is when you just rely on survey data, Instead, I look at what people do. And you can see what they do in many different ways. How they shop, how they vote, how they protest, where they go to mosque. All these things give us a greater insight into what they're trying to do to fill that void and have a greater spiritual life. There is a real need for that, a desire to have something more than just the material culture that's been a large part of modernity. And I think that what this reveals is something actually very hopeful. People have a longing for something more, and that's a good thing. It means that usually it's not about blowing yourself up, right? It's not about running into a bar and setting off a detonation. It's about trying to find something that will give you greater meaning and fulfillment in your life. And so when that can be channeled towards something positive, then we have a really hopeful thing to work with. Thank you.
Now, we'll still go on to for the radio. We'll take one more question, and I'll pose this question. What are Muslims in Europe doing about these issues themselves? I mean, they understand now there is a schism, obviously, you know, between themselves and about integration, the worry, you know, from, and sometimes even they describe it as racism from the Europeans. How are they trying to bridge this thing and try to work it out?
That's a great question, Jamal. And if you listen to people like Rush Limbaugh, which I don't necessarily advocate that you do, but if you do, and I like to because I find it in a strange way educational and informative, get into other people's minds, understand what they think, you hear them say very often, where are the Muslims that are outraged about the things that are going on? Why aren't they standing up and speaking out? Let me tell you about a man named Mustafa Yoldash. He is the leader of the Muslim, one of the elected leaders of the Muslim community in Hamburg. And I interviewed him repeatedly over the course of several years. He was a terror suspect because he was part of an organization called Milli Görüş that includes Turks living in Germany. And they had said inflammatory things, and so he had his phone tapped and his mail censored. We got to know each other, spent, you know, a bit of time together talking each time I would go to Hamburg. And he was actively engaged in civic outreach, spending most of his time talking about what it means to be a Muslim living in Europe, talking to non-Muslim groups. And one of the things he would do is organize interfaith, not protests, but marches. And they would be against the radical acts of extremists and in favor of greater understanding and dialogue. Unfortunately, this would get very little press, and I think this has been part of the problem, is that when things like that do occur, they're not as sexy or as exciting, you know, to see a bunch of clergy people from different religions getting together and holding hands and that sort of thing is just not as sexy as a bomb blowing up or people talking about their plots. So we get a very one-sided picture of events. Muslims are doing things, and always it's a mixed bag, a mixed picture. But there are things out there. We just don't get a lot of press about it. If we got more, then I think we'd see a clearer picture that things are not as bad as they seem. The threats are real, but we have to focus on the vast majority of people who want to be part of major mainstream Western society and just need policies that will include them more.
Well, on that note, that concludes our program for this evening. And so on behalf of the World Affairs Council of Northern California and our co-sponsor, Books, Inc., please join me in thanking Zachary Chor for sharing his insights with us. Many thanks to you, the audience, as well for your terrific questions. Mr. Chor will now be signing copies of his book on stage. Thank you and good night.